I am a naturalist rather than a scientist. And I have always been interested in simply looking at a flower or a frog or whatever. It has always seemed to me to be just about the most interesting thing there is around. Of course, other people would say human beings are pretty interesting, which of course they are. But at the same time, when you are making your own discoveries as a child, you aren't interested in Auntie Flo's psychology, but you are interested in how a dragonfly larva turns into a dragonfly. And that is just mind-blowing, exciting. And I cannot ever remember not being interested in such things.
Mm. Do you think, David, that there's a problem when you look at something like the difference between larval insects and adult insects? The animal is carrying around with it inside it two entirely separate blueprints, programs.
I couldn't believe it. I remember asking somebody, an adult who knew about things, I said, what goes on inside the cocoon? And he said, the caterpillar is totally broken down.
Yeah.
It's a kind of soup.
Goes down to soup and then starts
from
scratch.
And then it starts again.
Yes, yeah.
And I remember saying, that can't be right. It can't be right, but it is right.
Yes, it is right.
not quite entirely right. I mean, we now know that there are little centres that remain which aggregate things around them and so on. But it, as a procedure, it is... you can't imagine how it evolved, really.
Exactly. It's an evolutionary problem that somehow in evolution there had to be a divergence which sort of parallels the divergence we see between different evolutionary lineages, but actually happens within
one. Of course, there is a gradation of metamorphoses between larval forms and adult forms, which change one step at a time. And you can understand those. It's the total reorganization.
Yes.
And splitting of a life into the first-hand accumulation of food and growth, and therefore, sort of, as it were, bottled energy. And then suddenly, okay, well, now we're going to replicate.
It turns into a reproducing machine.
And then we're going to start... We need a completely different machine in order to do that.
With wings may not even
and
eat.
Who is it who's saying this?
Yes, yes. I mean, in the case of a mayfly larva...
Yeah, one day.
No eating, just flying around, just a totally different ecology, a different way of life. It is a fascinating thing.
One of the really, talking about mayflies, one of the things that really interests me or entertained me was I was looking at a mayfly rising in Hungary, and all these mayflies kept coming out. And of course they mate as soon as they emerge. The males are hanging around. They emerge first. Females come out. All the males dash down and get a female. So the female is impregnated. And then that's over. But then the female... What it then does is to fly upstream for a particular length of river that will actually be the length required to carry the fertilised egg back to the place where she emerged. Because if she didn't do that, the whole species would eventually go downriver and end up in the sea. So in order to maintain that footprint in that ecosystem, the female has to fly upstream by a mile and three quarters or whatever it is. And
I love that.
I mean, that's absolutely riveting.
That's just a wonderful story. The talking about mayflies reminds me of the idea of it's possible for an animal to be over-designed, to be too good. I mean, it's wasteful to have equipment put in there that you're not going to need. And so a natural selection sorts that out by saying that any individual that puts too much into being a mayfly, I mean, say, putting a gut in when you don't actually need it, it might one day come in handy, but nevertheless, the rival ones who don't put a gut in are the ones who do better. Nick Humphrey has this wonderful story, which I think he made up, but it's sort of plausible, about Henry Ford, who it said commissioned a survey of the scrapyards of America, looking at all the Model Ts, to find out what it was that finally broke down. And sometimes it was the clutch, and sometimes it was the gearbox, and sometimes it was this, that, and the other. But it was never the kingpins. And so Henry Ford decreed that in future the kingpins must be built to an inferior specification. I think you could do a similar thing if you went to, I don't know, the Far East and looked at gibbons who'd fallen out of trees. And if you could ever find a bone that was never broken, then you could say, this is too good. This is over-designed. Natural selection should have shaved a bit off the bones that never broke and put the calcium saved, whatever
into
it might be.
Into better
use. And it's absolutely right. It's not quite as simple as that, but there's a sort of constant adjusting of the balance of putting too much here, too little there. Because if you get it wrong, then a rival who's got it right actually succeeds in surviving better. Mm. Yeah. But I know you're working on a new project with fossil, with Cambrian and Precambrian. When's that coming out?
It comes out in the end of this year. And it's one of the I reckon we are living in the most exciting intellectual time in history. I reckon that in my lifetime, we have discovered such profundities, such huge principles. I mean, when I was an undergraduate, I went to the professor of geology at Cambridge and said, wouldn't you talk to us about the way that continents are drifting? Because there's South African, well, Holmes and various other people. And he said, when anybody can demonstrate to me, my dear Attenborough, that the continents move by a millimetre, I will consider it. But until then, it's sheer moonshine, dear boy. And of course, within 5 years of me leaving Cambridge, it was proved. And suddenly, all the problems disappeared. I mean, the problem of why Australia animals were different. And the absolutely bonkers explanations which we were told about how they chained and they'd migrated down the island chain from the northern hemisphere, but somehow or other there was a different way of reproducing which they acquired before or after, which was complete nonsense. So we were supposed to accept this. But that one thing in itself has totally changed our understanding and made sense of everything. And the big thing that I made 30 years ago, I made a series called Life on Earth. And we had to start with really complex organisms, really, because before then there was no evidence as to how there were stromatolites, and we knew that. But the ecology of the very first oceans was not known. And since that time, in the last hundred years, we have discovered so much. And one of the really rivetingly interesting things is that there is one particular kind of fossil from the Precambrian part of the geological column, which until quite recently was thought to be without any fossils of any kind. And these are animals that are fractal. Fractal animals mean that it means that they have a little process in which they grow and branch. And that is then replicated again and again and again and again and again of branching. And it's like crystals of ice on your window pane. That little element repeats itself, but it then makes it repeat in on a bigger dimension, a bigger dimension, a bigger dimension. And that's what the very early multicellular animals were like. And it was a dead end. It didn't work. Because if you have that method of growing, you can't develop a gut. You can't develop anything different. All you can do is that. And so you can absorb nutrients from the sea, but that's all you can do. And that took that to quite a large limit. I mean, some of these things are 2 feet long, you know, but they're fractal. And just sitting there, looking at the deposits, looking at the fossils, these a great landscape of fractal fossils. You know, I mean, thrilling.
It's an interesting idea that a group of animals could get locked into a particular way and then somehow can't back out again.
That's right.
In a way, that might tie into what we were talking earlier about larval forms. Alistair Hardy, long ago, suggested that using the larva as a way of, he called it the escape from specialisation, that if the adult form is stuck in a rut, as it might be fractal or some other kind of rut, then new evolution can take place by going to the larva. Branching off
Neotenous adults like us. I mean, we're not neotenous apes, aren't we?
And vertebrates may be neotenous sea squirts.
Mm. Yes. I hadn't thought of that. I'll have to ponder on that. That'll be something that will distract me in the
bath. I think they're the ones, aren't they, that they're said to eat their brain. That's the joke about when you get tenure, you settle down and eat your brain. I mean, in your Cambrian, pre-Cambrian fossil program, are you trying to reconstruct what it was actually like for the living animals? You were using kind of...
Computer graphics. Computer graphics now, I mean, I remember doing a program about dinosaurs, 15, 20 years ago, and I said, I'm not going to use computer graphics because they're so galumphing and cloddish and silly and kind of nursery. I mean, I won't, and I will try and... And I said in a rather pompous way, the interesting thing about dinosaurs is looking at the bones and deducing what the things are, not actually what the end product was. But now we have got computer graphics so good that you really cannot tell that they aren't the real thing.
Yes.
I mean, of course, in a way you cheat, because what you do is you look at a fossil from the Precambrian and you say, well, it must have been an arthropod and it must have done this and it must have had claws and it must have moved in a certain way. And then you go to something that is like that today and you abstract that quiddity, that essence of what it is about the movement, and you put it onto that evidence of your fossil evidence. So it's not surprising that the thing comes out looking like alive.
Yes.
But the fact of the matter is, I could show you now a real crustacean, a mantis shrimp, for example, and then go to a thing like Anomalocaris, which is a pre-Cambrian, or it's early Cambrian, actually, a crustacean, and you can't tell which is alive and which is not.
That's wonderful, yes. So do you sort of virtually swim around with an Anomalocaris in a Cambrian sea?
Yeah.
How wonderful.
It's absolutely sensational, these animals. I mean, they are they're so interesting. And of course, we now, with the net and one thing and another and the web, you can produce a computer graphic and you can put it on the line to someone in Australia and say, look, do you think this is what it looks like?
Yes.
And then when you come back in the morning, they say, no, I think you should actually increase the undulations by such and such and so on, so because I've seen this. So that what we now have on these computer graphics has been seen by all the scientists who are working with that particular species, which is again...
Sort of within a day.
Marvellous, in a day.
Yes.
It's really thrilling. But you are doing a child's book, children's book.
But that's about science more generally. And so I've got chapters on things like what is the sun, what is an earthquake. And the thing about the book is that each chapter begins with myths. So we have what is the sun, a few myths about the sun, an Aztec myth, an ancient Egyptian myth, an Aboriginal myth, and then what really is the sun. And so the idea is not to belittle the myths, because they're fascinating in their own right. But there is a genuine distinction between a myth and what's really true. And we do know what's true. In many cases, and we can explain how we know what's true. I mean, one of the problems that I think we've both faced, and especially you will be facing now with your fossil program, is trying to convey the sheer magnitude of geological time.
Impossible.
And it's very, very difficult. And I think at various times you've used a clock, and you know we're living at 1 second before midnight or whatever it is, or you can use a calendar. Do you know the one where you stick your arm out? And you say the beginning, middle of my neck is the origin of life, and the tip of my finger is the present. And you get nothing but bacteria sort of up there. And the dinosaurs are somewhere in the middle of the palm of your hand.
Yeah.
And then fossil man somewhere about your fingernail. And then the whole of human history, the Babylonians, the Greeks, all of human history is the dust from one stroke of a nail file.
Yeah, but in the end, of course, you can't be quantitative. In the end, it's just an unimaginable long time ago.
And you try to boggle their mind with some sort of...
I mean, yes, you do. I'm all for mind boggling. Yeah. I'm doing it in this programme. I'm going whizzing back. Calendars and things.
Yes.
But in the end, all it is, I mean, you can't imagine it. It isn't comprehensible. It isn't graspable. It's just an unimaginable long time ago.
Yes. David, could I ask, could we just talk about life as we see it on this planet, which you've probably seen more than anybody else? And to what extent do you think life sort of had to be the way it is? And to what extent could it have been completely different if you were to restart in the Cambrian or later than the camel?
I think the answer is, you asked it just recently. Convergent evolution provides you the answer to that.
Yes. So when you look at an Australian, well, indeed the whole Australian mammal fauna, and compare it with that in the Old World and that in South America, which was another. And to some extent in Madagascar and other such places, you see such amazing similarities, but also some very tantalising differences. I mean, in Australia, the antelope niche is filled by two-legged hoppers rather than four-legged gallopers. And that seems to be, once they started on that down that road, then they were committed to carrying on as two-legged hoppers.
But you have to have bilateral symmetry. You have to have your sense organs at the front and your speech organs at the back, you know.
So if you were to ask the question, if there's life on Mars or some other planet, how similar would we expect it to be?
And the answer is that they moved, their sense organs would not be in their backsides.
That's right, yes, yeah. David, have you ever thought of doing, maybe you've already done it, a programme about islands?
I have done programmes about islands, yes.
I mean, they come in, of course, biology, all the time. But
and they're very interesting because it's like reducing the number of elements that you have in order to see how the reaction is more clearly. And that's
yes.
the interesting
thing. And the same principles apply across all sorts of different kinds of islands. They're enormously important evolutionarily. And if the world was just one big landmass with totally uniform conditions, I suppose you'd have a certain amount of evolution, but
not
I mean,
much.
It would be terribly boring.
Not much.
Almost no
and
diversity.
That was a great relief to me, 20, 30 years ago, when I suddenly realised that eco-isolation was essential for evolution.
Yes.
And which, I think Gould or someone was involved in that sort of view, wasn't he? Maybe you know better.
Well, Ernst Mayr.
Oh, Mayr, yes, Ernst Mayr. Yes. Yeah. Who I met. 100
yes.
years old.
Yes, me too.
My
yes.
name is Ernst Mayr, and I'm 100 years old.
Yes.
And I'm publishing this book on the birds of paradise, he said. I was thrilled.
Yes.
It was in Harvard.
Yes.
100 years old.
Yes.
I had the front of being lecturing.
Yeah.
How can you imagine? Lecturing on birds of paradise, and in comes this man
who was a
legend,
walking
I mean, in
history,
a literal
yes.
sense.
Yes.
100 years. Ah,
yes.
That is my name. I'm 100 years old, and I'm going thinking about these things you are going to lecture about for 100 years. God, that's a great way to start.
Yeah.